Good morning. You are tuned in to Community Radio, listener-supported KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on this morning's magazine, we'll hear from Joe Salazar, former state representative and executive director of Colorado Rising. They already have launched six ballot measures that they're hoping to ultimately get on the 2020 statewide ballot. Joe Salazar will be part of a panel discussion that is happening in Longmont on Thursday evening on air quality as a result of fracking activities. We'll hear why he is concerned about air quality and the various different strategies that Colorado Rising and other groups are taking on to tackle fracking in the state. After that, we'll hear from Dana Fisher. She's the author of the new book, American Resistance, From the Women's March to the Blue Wave. She's speaking at the Tattered Cover on Colfax in Denver this evening, and she'll be at the Boulder Bookstore tomorrow. We'll hear about the resistance movement and where it goes after the 2020 elections. Then two regular Wednesday morning features, Make Them Hear You and Naturally with Brigitte Mars. After headlines from the BBC and a commentary from Jim Hightower, Joe Juhas is in for good old CU. Then at 9 o'clock, we'll hear from Tracy Farrell. She's a professor at CU Boulder, and she's the author of a new book, Migrating for Medical Marijuana, Pioneers in a New Frontier of Treatment, where she chronicles the stories of people who have moved to the state in search of medical marijuana, self-proclaimed refugees seeking treatment that's unavailable elsewhere. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Here's Jamie Sudler.
Two environmental groups filed a new case yesterday calling for a judge to determine whether local communities and governments can ban fracking. The activist organizations Our Health, Our Future, Our Longmont and Food and Water Watch brought the case in Boulder District Court. The issue is whether Senate Bill 181 that was signed into law last year provides local governments with the authority to prohibit fracking. The groups say that the bill legislatively nullifies an earlier state Supreme Court decision that overturned a ban by Longmont. Joe Salazar, the attorney representing the plaintiffs, said that the powers granted to local governments by Senate Bill 181 did not prohibit fracking bans. He said that residents of Longmont have suffered injury and could suffer future injury to their health and safety and property interests. Casey Becker, the Speaker of the State House of Representatives and a Democrat from Boulder, told the Daily Camera that while Senate Bill 181 was not a measure to create bans, if there are legal means under it to get fracking out of Boulder County, then she supports that. She noted that a ban must be based on a finding by the county commissioners about a specific site where drilling is proposed. Boulder County commissioners are currently considering their legal ability to enact a fracking ban and will hold a public hearing to discuss it further on January 28th. Legislators at the state capitol introduced a bill yesterday to repeal the state's death penalty. Senate Bill 100 would remove the death penalty as an option for prosecutors in Class 1 felony cases for those people charged after July 1st this year. If enacted, someone convicted of such a crime would automatically face a life sentence without the possibility of parole. This is the sixth attempt to repeal capital punishment in recent years. Last year, an effort faced opposition in the state Senate from Senator Rhonda Fields, a Democrat from Aurora, whose son and his fiance were murdered. Their killers were sentenced to death. Denver 7 reports that this year the measure has the support of Republican sponsors and co-sponsors, which could help push it over the edge in the Senate. One Republican sponsor, Jack Tate of Centennial, said the death penalty no longer fits his beliefs when it comes to the value of life, and when he considers that some death row inmates have been proven innocent. Governor Jared Polis said last year that he would have signed a repeal measure, and a spokesperson said that he would consider many factors should the legislature pass the bill this session. Also at the legislature yesterday, lawmakers debated whether 38 climate protesters should have been arrested for delaying the governor's State of the State speech at the Capitol last week. The Denver Post reports that last Thursday, several protesters urged action on the climate and shouted various calls for new policies, including a fracking ban, minutes before the governor's speech. They were arrested on suspicion of trespassing, among other charges. Some were physically dragged out in handcuffs. Representative Jonathan Singer, a Democrat from Longmont, told House members that the punishment of being arrested, in some cases held for more than 24 hours, did not fit the crime because they didn't present any physical danger. However, Hugh McKean, a Republican from Loveland, said that while he recognizes the importance of civil disobedience, a protester must accept the consequences if it's in a place where it shouldn't be. The Denver District Attorney's Office is waiting for all the arrest reports before coming to any resolution, according to a spokesperson. Yesterday, the Longmont City Council voted unanimously to support the and allow refugees from other countries to move to the city under a federal resettlement program. The resolution stems from an executive order by President Donald Trump that requires state and local governments to provide written consent for settlements in their jurisdictions. On Monday night, the Aurora City Council also unanimously approved a similar resolution supporting refugee resettlement. After some discussion, all Aurora Council members agreed to include language stating that refugees who have settled in Aurora have had a positive effect on the city. The Times Call reports that both the city of Boulder and Boulder County have adopted similar measures, as have the state of Colorado and other local governments. Today, the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Commission will consider the legality of organized contests to kill animals. A coalition of organizations, including Wild Earth Guardians and the Humane Society of the United States, submitted a petition over the practice last November. A release from Parks and Wildlife describes killing contests that target coyotes, prairie dogs, and other animals for money or other prizes. They are currently permitted by the state, provided that no more than five of each species is taken by any individual. In the past 2 years, both Arizona and Massachusetts banned all predator and fur-buried animal killing contests, and California banned them about 6 years ago. Agency staff will make a presentation to the commission this afternoon about the contests at the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Facility on North Broadway in Denver. In today's weather, it will be sunny with a high near 48 and breezy with gusts above 30 miles per hour at times. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high near 49. Right now, it's about 28 along the Front Range. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
It is 11 minutes past 8 o'clock. Well, as we heard in headlines, there are now more efforts to block oil and gas activity in Boulder County. One particular area of concern for residents in the county is the quality of air as a result of fracking. Well, tomorrow evening in Longmont, there will be a panel discussion on air quality, and one of the speakers will be Joe Salazar. He's a former state representative and he's the executive director of Colorado Rising.
Yeah, so air quality has is hugely impacted by the oil and gas industry. And what we know, and I'm really interested in hearing this from Detlef Helmig, is how all the fracking activities that are happening in the Weld County area, how they're affecting Longmont. It's my understanding that the way that the air works with fracking activities happening in Weld County, happening south of Longmont and Erie and other places, that it seems to be particularly trapped in the Longmont area. And I think that that's a big concern for Longmont residents.
Of course, with the way state regulations are, and particularly after the passage of Senate Bill 181, that gives local communities more control. So you have entities like Boulder County that are seeking to enact more control and tighter regulations over fracking. But then you have a neighbouring county like Weld County that is using Senate Bill 181 to say, hey, we want even more oil and gas activity in our county. And so the way the current legislation is, and that local control effort, that we're seeing maybe a bigger impact when we have neighbouring counties that have a completely different attitude and stance when it comes to oil and gas regulation. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I think the way that Weld County is looking at Senate Bill 181 is a fallacy. 181 is extremely clear that it establishes a floor to protect public health, safety, welfare, the environment, and wildlife resources. The way that Weld County takes a look at 181 is that it gives them local control to do whatever the hell they want, and that's not what it's intended for. A local government can have more strict and more protective regulations over the oil and gas industry, but it cannot fall below that floor. And so Weld County is, I believe, is operating outside the guidelines of the law, and I think that they are just setting themselves up for a lawsuit if they don't straighten up.
And would that lawsuit come from a neighboring county like Boulder County, or is that something that state regulators need to tackle, and particularly the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, the COGCC?
I think, you know, that's a really good question. And it really depends on who's willing to take on that lawsuit. I mean, it seems to fall under the primary jurisdiction of the COGCC, but we've noted as of late that they're not doing anything against Weld County. But neighboring counties possibly could look at suing their neighboring county in Weld for violating Senate Bill 181 and violating the health, safety, and welfare of their own residents.
Of course, the state hasn't been shy about launching their own lawsuits against communities when those communities try to enact more control over oil and gas. I mean, I'm thinking of Longmont itself. Longmont was sued by the state of Colorado when it tried to enforce a voter-approved ban on fracking. And so it doesn't seem that the state has a history of suing communities, but it seems its history is when it's siding with the side of the oil and gas industry.
That's exactly right. I think that's the key ending to your statement, is that the state of Colorado doesn't have any problems suing communities when it comes to favoring the oil and gas industry. But we haven't seen the state of Colorado actually take those protective stances as required by Senate Bill 181 to protect communities. Yesterday morning, Colorado Rising, on behalf of our Longmont and Food and Water Watch, we filed a declaratory judgment action in Boulder County Court to have the court declare that Amendment 16 of the Longmont Municipal Charter, which bans fracking in the city of Longmont, that it is now within the guidelines of the law of the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Act, as a result of the passage of Senate Bill 181. And so we're asking the Boulder County Court to say, yeah, Longmont's fracking ban is now within the guidelines of the law, and it needs to be enforced. You know, we believe, as Colorado Rising, we believe that we need to take whatever action is needed in order to protect our communities. And if that means reviving a ban such as Longmont's, then we will do that. If that means that we have to turn around and sue the COGCC for its failure to enforce its own laws, then we will do that too. If it means that we have to take on the oil and gas industry in order to protect our communities from this abusive industry, we will do that too. That's the beauty of our judicial system, is that where the federal government or where the state government fails, people can pick it up and protect themselves.
That's Joe Salazar, who is the executive director of Colorado Rising. He's a former state representative. And of course, Colorado Rising has introduced six potential ballot measures that they're hoping to see at least some of them get on the statewide ballot. And we're going to do a lot more coverage of that. We'll direct people to yesterday's Metro show with Colorado Rising, a half hour discussion on what those ballot measures are. You can find that archive at kgnu.org/metro. Now, Joe Salazar will be participating in a panel discussion happening tomorrow evening in Longmont. And this is a panel called Unbreathable, Unacceptable, How Can We Get Clean Air? Taking a look at the impact of oil and gas activity on air quality. Joe Salazar will be joined by Dr. Detlev Helmig, who is a research professor at the Institute of Alpine and Arctic Research, that's INSTAR at CU Boulder. And he has been doing air quality monitoring at the Boulder Reservoir. Also on the panel tomorrow will be Senator Mike Foote, a state representative. And it's all happening from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. on Thursday evening. It's called the Longmont Sunrise Movement Rally, and it's happening at Sunset Middle School in the cafeteria at the school, and that's at 1300 South Sunset Street in Longmont. And we're going to hear more about air quality as a result of oil and gas activity and climate change as well. There's another conference that is happening this week in Denver on that issue, so we'll hear more on this tomorrow morning on The Morning Magazine. It is 18 minutes past 8 o'clock. You're listening to KGNU. Well, Dana Fisher is a sociologist, and she has been looking at resistance movements, and particularly taking a look at what happened in the wake of the Women's March. And she chronicles what happened from the Women's March all the way to the Blue Wave, the midterm elections of 2018. She writes about it in her new book, American Resistance, From the Women's March to the Blue Wave. She'll be speaking at the Tattered Cover in Denver this evening and at the Boulder Bookstore tomorrow evening.
This whole project began as I observed all the outrage that bubbled up across the country after the election of Donald Trump due to many of the things that happened during the campaign and actually the outcome of the election itself, given that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote but lost the Electoral College, et cetera, and so forth. And many people were also expecting Hillary Clinton to win because a lot of the pollsters were suggesting that she was extremely likely to win. So when the Women's March was called, I assembled a research team, and it looked like it was going to be, initially it looked like it was going to be, you know, a really interesting coalition of people who were going to be coming out to the Women's March, which was scheduled for the day after the inauguration in 2017. In fact, we're coming up on the fourth anniversary of the Women's March this weekend, and so people are planning events across the country. And what happened was that not only did it look like it was going to be this really innovative group, coalition of organizations and interests that were going to show up in the streets, but in Washington, D.C., it started becoming clear that it was going to be huge. And so when we got out there, it was really quite remarkable. I mean, I've been studying protests since I began as an academic in 1999, and this was the largest event I'd ever been to, and it was really just awe-inspiring. It ended up being the largest day of protests in U.S. history, so it makes sense that it seemed so big, because it was, in fact, big. And, in fact, one of the things that's so interesting about the Women's March is that it didn't just happen in Washington, D.C., although the focus was to march to Washington, if you could, to the nation's capital, to march in the same streets where the inauguration had taken place. But the march, you know, marches took place around the country. I know in Denver there was a big march, in Los Angeles there was a big march, New York, Chicago, et cetera, and so forth. So people marched all over the country. And it became clear to me as we saw what unfolded afterwards. We had the travel ban, or the attempt at a travel ban, that happened a week later, and people started protesting at airports and providing support to people who were stranded because of the travel ban, or the attempt to implement the travel ban, at least. And then we saw many other marches scheduled. So it became clear to me that the Women's March in 2017 was the starting point for this heightened level of civic engagement, activism, and protest. We actually, as scholars, have started thinking about this as this cycle of contention, which is a cycle that began in a lot of ways with the Women's March. As I talk about in the book, I think of the Women's March as the spark that ignited the resistance, because since that time, we have seen people marching in the streets repeatedly. And as I document in the book, I look at all the people who participated in the largest marches that have happened since, and including the Women's March 2017, and I trace the ways that people didn't just march in the streets, but also got involved in their communities and their congressional districts. And I followed them through the midterm elections, which is when I talk about the blue wave.
If we look even past the election, and if there is another blue wave that we saw in the midterm elections, what happens to that energy that has been unleashed really after the election of Donald Trump? Where does that go, and can that be harnessed and channeled so that we actually see real social change, and it's not just something that happens around elections?
That is a super important question. And many people are starting to think about it, but nobody has a clear answer. I mean, I can tell you this. As I document in the book, the resistance, the American resistance, is made up of a very fragile coalition of organizations that have unified against a common enemy, which is Donald Trump and his administration and their policies. If a real blue wave happens, where all of a sudden we wake up in, 2021, when the inauguration happens, with a Democratic Congress and a Democratic White House, it's going to be hard to continue to maintain the energy and enthusiasm that we've seen these past few years. It's doable, but the organizations that have been helping to channel the energy into specific types of political tasks around, for example, the midterm election, around specific political issues, like we saw around health care, around the travel ban, to some degree around gun violence, those organizations are going to have to figure out ways to work together to keep channeling energy, because there's no question that getting the capacity to change the policies is the first step, and that requires a blue wave. That means that requires progressive political representation in in the political realm, in both at the national level as well as in states across the country, because right now there are many, many more legislatures that are Republican-led and governorships that are Republican-led than there are Democratic-led ones. And that needs to change to address issues like gerrymandering, voter suppression, as well as thinking through how to have more transparency in government. And then there are all the progressive issues that so many people on the left and so many people in the American resistance have been focusing on, and they've been protesting around, and then they've also been doing so much more. So I think that it's going to take the organizations really staying involved, and there's going to be a lot of infrastructure built among organizations to do the hard work that's going to be required to get to a positive blue outcome in 2020. And the question is, what do they do with that infrastructure when the election's over by the end of November 2020? And that will determine what comes next and what's feasible and what, you know, what's possible in terms of policymaking.
Dana Fisher will speak about her new book, American Resistance, From the Women's March to the Blue Wave. She'll be at the Tattered Cover on Colfax in Denver this evening at 7, where she'll be in conversation with Ian Silverdi, who is the Executive Director of Progress Now Colorado. And tomorrow evening at 7:30 p.m., she'll be speaking about the book at the Boulder Bookstore. It is 8:25. You're listening to KGNU. Time now for Make Them Hear You.
Make them hear you. Make them hear you.
This is Make Them Hear You, with ideas how you can have your voice heard before Congress. Usually I try to talk about bills that have some chance of passing, and I often avoid the impeachment issue because so much else is flying under the radar. But here is an impeachment issue that at least deserves attention, even if this action is very unlikely to yield results. Donald Trump has been impeached by the House, and the impeachment is likely to be delivered soon to the Senate. In the meantime, Senator Lindsey Graham of the Judiciary Committee and Leader Mitch McConnell continue to push judicial nominees onto the bench. The Fair Courts Task Force of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, a coalition of over 200 national organizations committed to promoting and protecting the civil and human rights, has made a, quote, common sense demand that should be respected. The articles of impeachment recently approved by the House of Representatives state that the President of the United States has abused the powers of his office and has obstructed Congress. Few things could be more toxic to a free people than to have the chief executive act as if he is above the law and abuse the authority temporarily entrusted to him by sabotaging our democratic system of government established by the Constitution. While any president is under the cloud of impeachment for such high crimes and misdemeanors, the Senate and the Judiciary Committee must put a hold on processing that president's nominees for a lifetime position in the federal judiciary. Proceeding with lifetime judicial nominees would be an abdication of the Senate's role in the separation of powers that protect our liberty. Until the Senate holds a fair trial and exonerates the president, it should confirm no further judicial nominees. As long as the cloud of impeachment exists, it would be a grave mistake for the Senate to allow the president to continue making lifetime appointments to the federal judiciary. Such appointments are nearly irrevocable. Federal judges serve for life and can be removed only through their own impeachment. A president under the cloud of impeachment for abusing his power and assaulting the legitimacy of our elections cannot be trusted to appoint the judges who are supposed to protect our elections and the right to vote. The Senate must come together now to do what is right and choose country over partisan interest. As long as the current crisis continues, business cannot continue as normal, and the Senate must stop consideration of the president's judicial nominees. Close quote. I am convinced that if you share your thoughts on this issue, that Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell will ignore you. But sometimes it's worthy to go ahead and make a call or mail in the postcard, simply so the American people's voice is heard. And just a reminder, the Women's March is this Saturday. No, you won't get Donald Trump to change his ways if you march, but you will show by sheer strength of numbers that America is ready for a new way of being together. Maybe I'll see some of you there. This is Chris Moore with Make Them Hear You.
Greetings. Welcome to Naturally. This is Brigitte Mars to talk about herbs that can help us overcome addiction. You know, addiction is such a huge problem. We hear about it in the news every day. And one of the big things we hear so much about is pain medicine, opiate addiction. And I realized that, you know, we do have substances on our planet that can help us to relieve pain, and that, you know, the rest that comes from sleeping deeply after surgery or an accident could really be very helpful. But when we are still using a substance, you know, months or years later, and it's not really serving us and it's damaging our kidneys and liver, which almost all addictive substances do, it's time to have another look. So it is good to know that there are other herbs that can help to relieve pain. So we can think about an herb called corydalis, which is in the same family as opium poppy. Corydalis is, it does grow here in Colorado, and it is not addictive. It does help in pain relief. It's not as strong as morphine, but it is very pain relieving, and it's not addictive. It's both analgesic and sedative. So that's something that you might want to use. I also think of California poppy, also in the poppy or Papaveraceae family. So California poppy is a beautiful plant. You can grow it here, even though it is the state flower of California. It flourishes well in Colorado. It's an analgesic, an anodyne, a hypnotic. It calms the spirit, helps to relieve anxiety and restlessness. And this might be an herb to use when giving up alcohol, tobacco, or prescription drugs. There's also been a lot of talk about kratom or kratom, and I know it's a very heated subject, but many people are finding out that that can help them to get rid of an addiction. However, there are some dangers associated with kratom, and I think a lot of product adulteration. But I saw a movie recently called Sweet Relief. No, it was called A Leaf of Faith, A Leaf of Faith. And that might just give you some more information about kratom. It's an herb in the same family as coffee, and it can help people let go of opium addiction. Thanks for joining me, Brigitte Mars, on Naturally.